91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. This hour, we're at your service with a call-in program about stroke research, latest technology, and how to cope with the aftermath. Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman. Stroke is the fifth leading cause of death in the U.S. Rates for older Americans are on the decline, yet on the rise for Gen Xers. The causes may be higher obesity, type 2 diabetes, and less emphasis on lowered blood pressure. We'll also touch on comprehensive stroke center hospitals with vascular neurologist Dr. Felipe de los Rios. And also hear from South Florida-based author Elaine Dietz, who's chronicled her personal battle after surviving multiple strokes. Next up, Topical Currents at your service. First, this news. Six minutes past 1 o'clock. It is today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman. Well, we're at your service this hour with the latest information about strokes. Every 40 seconds in the U.S., someone has a stroke.
In every 4 minutes, someone dies of one. Stroke is also the leading cause of long-term disability in the United States. We'll turn now to Dr. Felipe de los Rios, a leading South Florida-based vascular neurologist and researcher. He's affiliated with the Florida International University Wertheim College of Medicine. Welcome to you, doctor.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
I think I would like to start really simply. What is a stroke?
Right. So stroke happens when an area of the brain does not get enough blood. So blood brings oxygen, brings nutrients to the brain. So if for whatever reason blood is not able to get to the brain cells, then those brain cells suffocate over a brief period of time. And then that damage is irreversible. So brain cells don't regenerate like skin cells do. So once those brain cells get permanently injured, and that's when the stroke happens.
And how does a stroke... Well, let me ask you this. What are the most frequent causes of a stroke? Why do we get them?
The most common risk factor for stroke would be hypertension. So high blood pressure over a long period of time damages the arteries, the smallest arteries that go to the brain. And that's the most common risk factors. But others that are very common are diabetes, for example, tobacco use. Tobacco injures the arteries directly as well. Alcohol abuse, obesity. So those are the most common ones. Atrial fibrillation, which is a heart condition that predisposes to clot formation, is very common as well.
And could you distinguish between the two major types?
Yes, so we actually divide them in three major categories. The most common one is ischemic stroke. So in those strokes, there's a lack of blood going to an area of the brain. Then that's about 85% of the time or so. Then about 10% of the time, there's actually blood vessel ruptures. So there's blood that's leaked into the brain. Now, there's an excess of blood inside the brain, but that blood is not getting to the brain cells.
Okay.
So there's damage that way, and there's also damage because of...
It's sort of drowning them, then.
In some ways, yes. And that happens about 10% of the time. And then about 3% of the time, a blood vessel ruptures, not inside the brain itself, but in the convexity of it, the outside part of the brain, and that's called a subarachnoid hemorrhage. And that's the type of blood that happens when you have like an aneurysm rupture or so. And so those are the three main groups for strokes.
And what happens in a transient ischemic attack?
Right. So what happens there is there's an area of the brain that didn't get enough blood. So that's within the ischemic category,
right.
The lack of blood flow. And it's a brief period. So the brain cells aren't functioning very well because they're not getting enough oxygen, they're not getting enough nutrients. But the time is so brief that once it's restored, there's no permanent injury.
What does brief time mean?
So we know that brain cells don't sustain more than 4.5, 6 hours in general of lack of blood flow. And most of the TIAs are 30 minutes or less, maybe up to an hour or so. But so you can have some mild difficulties moving your arm or speaking or feeling or even seeing, but it lasts about 30 minutes, an hour, and then it resolves completely. So, you know, then you really have an opportunity.
But you've had one.
Right. So that's a TIA. It's not a stroke because there's no permanent injury on your brain.
But someone experiencing those symptoms should seek help.
Absolutely. Because then you know
you don't know that it's transient.
Exactly. Not only you don't know that it's transient, but if you've already had one or one of these events, then you're at higher risk of having one that might actually be permanent.
Are there warning signs for a stroke? It seems like the symptoms and signs of a stroke are difficult to identify from what I'm reading. Are there warning signs before the symptoms set in?
Right. So we use an acronym. It's called FAST. And this is probably the best way to learn how to pick up on symptoms. But it's sudden onset of face weakness, arm weakness, or leg. Speech difficulties, and then the T is for time, because time is of the essence. Again, you know, brain cells don't survive long without oxygen. So it's usually one side of the body, and you don't have to have everything. So if you just have an arm problem or a speech problem or a face problem, that's enough. Then you have to go call 911 and be taken
to
an emergency room.
What would the face problem look like? You talked about a weak face.
Yeah, so it's usually
distorted.
It's usually you're not able to move one side of the face. So online, there's some videos and things from the American Heart Association, which you can look at. Maybe we can, you know, put some of those links on the webpage too. But you're not able to move one side of the face. It's usually like the lower face, so it's kind of droopy. And if you talk, then one side will move appropriately, but the other side won't. So some people will say like your face is pulled to one side,
but that's actually
the normal side.
What if
that's
it's
moving.
Almost like a Novocaine kind of feel?
There can be numbness. There's not always numbness, but usually there is some degree of it.
But those are the symptoms of a stroke.
Those are the symptoms of a stroke or a TIA. Remember the TIA?
Right.
Their symptoms are pretty much the same.
But are there any warning symptoms that people get before the FAST acronym?
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
Not necessarily. Sometimes you can have headaches, but it's not very common. But you can have headaches come with it. But the way to understand this is the brain is really what allows you to engage with your surroundings. So sensation, what you feel, what you see. When people speak, the interpretation of what they're saying, language, eating, moving, all of that is really done through your brain. And when this happens, it's sudden. So that's the key part. It's sudden. You were fine 10 seconds ago, and now you are not. And once you understand that, when you have a sudden onset, usually of lack of function, so you were able to see, move, talk fine, and then all of a sudden, you can't understand what people are saying. Mm-hmm. You're not able to follow commands. You're not able to move one side. You're not able to feel one side, or you're not able to speak fine. Any of that suddenness of it, that sudden onset, is what really makes stroke high on the disease that you're thinking about as a medical provider. When you say it's this sudden onset thing, is what really gets you thinking about this problem.
And what if you're alone?
Yeah.
Right, so that's tricky. And many times, again, the brain is what makes you aware of what's happening. So if you have an area of the brain that's affected, you might not be aware that you're actually having
because your
brain is affected. So you're not aware. And this happens occasionally. It doesn't happen all the time. Most of the time, people are actually aware that something's wrong. But then they decide to wait, you know, it's gonna go away. It's just some, you know, mild weakness of my arm. I'm not going to call 911. I'm just going to wait. And that's the error, because then you're losing time that is very valuable.
We're going to talk about the different kinds of stroke treatment centers. But when you call 911, you don't really have a choice of where you're going to go usually. They take you to the nearest facility, right?
That's true. And when we talk about pre-hospital care of stroke and systems of care, and that's really where we're all moving fast towards, I can tell you that we've been working very closely with EMS and the chiefs to develop a stroke algorithm for our county. Uh-huh. And this is going to start very soon, actually. March 1st is my understanding. But now we're going to be implementing a new scale, a new evaluation for patients who come in, who call in with stroke symptoms. And it's very protocolized as to, you know, if you have this type of symptoms or this severity of symptoms, then you need to go to a comprehensive a hospital that is able to offer, you know, all the options for stroke care. But if your stroke is a little milder or so, or the suspicion is a little less, then you might be able to go to a primary stroke center, and you have to go to the closest one because time is so important. So then EMS has a list. They have the list of the hospitals, and they work with us regularly. We meet regularly. So they know which is a primary stroke center, what's a comprehensive stroke center. They call us in advance when they're coming to let us know, so we're ready to do everything fast. So it, especially in areas like Miami, where we have lots of hospitals that can provide stroke care, it's great to have this type of system set up. So you don't lose time. You're not thinking about where you need to go. EMS knows. They know what's closest. They know the different levels.
That's really good.
So you just need to call 911.
Comprehensive rated hospitals in Broward as well?
Yes. Yes.
And Palm Beach?
Yes. I mean, there's the list is online.
We're going to, okay, and we're going to have a link to that. And we're going to discuss more about this and the certification and all that.
Right.
When I asked you what caused a stroke, you listed, you know, diabetes, tobacco, obesity, hypertension. Mm-hmm. What about unpreventable? Those are all preventable, right? Aren't there some unpreventable
or
risk factors?
Genetic?
Yeah, genetic.
There is,
for example.
There is definitely. Fortunately, it's not the what has the most weight on it. For the most part, are modifiable risk factors, and that's why it's important for us to talk about this, because you actually have power over your health in this particular situation. So it's very important for people to know that you can impact how your health is going to be 20, 30 years down the road. So especially if you are, you know, young adult, middle-aged or so, and you want to see yourself 30 years enjoying your health and your grandchildren and all that, where you really have to work now is specifically on that. You do regular exercises, make sure your blood pressure, you know, you check your blood pressure with your primary care, that it's with it where it needs to be, that you check your glucose, you know, regularly, make sure that it's where it needs to be, that you eat healthy, that you don't smoke, that you drink alcohol in moderation, and that you follow a healthy diet. And if you do those simple things, you're going to be in good shape 20, 30 years. Now, this is all probabilities, of course, so you can say, hey, you know, I did all that and I still had a stroke.
Right.
And that's where some of that genetics comes in, and also some of our own aging comes in. You know, there is some wear and tear on the whole body.
I was surprised. I read that more than 34% of people hospitalized for stroke now are less than 65 years old. Are strokes affecting younger people in more frequency now?
Yes, we think so.
Why?
So we don't know specifically, you know, we can't say there's one specific cause as to why that is. But what we have been seeing is illnesses that you would typically see at older ages are starting to happen a little younger. And, you know, we have an obesity problem nationally. We have a blood pressure as well, diet. So all those things are making illnesses that you would see later in life happens, you know, sooner.
Sooner. Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Dr. Felipe de los Rios. He's a vascular neurology specialist, and we're going to find out what that is, too, and introduce another guest when we come back from this short break. Welcome back to today's Topical Currents. We are talking about strokes and perhaps how to prevent them and how to treat them, and the latest in that that particular field. Bonnie Berman with Joseph Cooper. We continue our At Your Service program, and at this time, with Dr. Felipe de los Rios. At this time, we introduce Elaine Vietz. She's a South Florida-based author and is here to tell us a bit about her long battle with surviving and recovering from strokes. Welcome to you, Elaine.
Hi, Bonnie.
I just have to say, to look at you, it's hard to believe.
I feel the same way.
That in 2007, you had six strokes. You must be a very fortunate person. What happened?
At the time, I was 57 years old, and I was preparing to go on a book tour. And I'd had 4 days of headaches. And I was supposed to give a speech on a Saturday morning. And I had trouble tying the belt on my robe. And then I was going to fix breakfast, and I handed my husband a fork. And I said, how does that work? And he looked astounded. And he called my internist, and she said, go immediately to the ER. And the neurologist on call examined me and said that I was too young and fit to have a stroke, and which is not true. And he sent me home. And 3 days later, I had six strokes, including a hemorrhagic stroke, brain surgery. I was in a coma for a week, and I spent 3 months in the hospital and 4 years to recover.
And in what period of time did you have those six strokes?
Apparently, since I was out of it within a very short time.
It's really a little nerve-wracking to hear that the doctor didn't recognize the symptoms of a stroke when, how are we supposed to know if a doctor doesn't even recognize them, you know?
It is nerve-wracking, and more nerve-wracking, he's still practicing. So I think we need to understand ourselves, and this hospital was billed as one of the 50 best in the United States. So you really need to know the signs yourself, and your family has to know them, so that when someone says you're too young and fit to have a stroke, you need to go to a stroke center.
Now, it seemed your early symptoms were cognitive. The business with the fork and that. Mm-hmm. Did you also feel something?
The headaches.
Just
a tingling or anything?
I had piercing headaches, and I could barely see because I had like cut glass halos all around.
Was your speech or your mobility affected?
Only toward the very end, and that's when I couldn't tie a bow in my robe. I just held the two ends up and couldn't figure it out.
So how were you able to recover each time, and how difficult and painful for you was recovery?
Recovery was a long, long process.
You said it was 4 years?
4 years. It was 3 months worth of physical therapy in the hospital. And then it was more physical therapy as an outpatient for at least a year after that. And I used a walker, and then I used a cane for 2 years, and I kept up the exercise and, you know, the usual good diet, workout. But mostly I was tired. I was really, really tired and unable to cope with things. And I found when my desk, I couldn't handle anything, and so my desk was covered with papers. And rather than address that, I started packing them away in suitcases. I couldn't handle anything. And so it got to the point that I needed to go on a trip, and all my suitcases were full of papers.
So you had nothing to pack in.
So it's a step-by-step process where you slowly start recovering, and then you start tackling at your old life and trying to get it back literally piece by piece.
Doctor, how do you view Elaine's story?
Yeah, I mean, headaches piercing headaches are not a common symptom for stroke. We see it. You can have some degree of headaches in about 30%. They're usually not piercing. There are different types of strokes, which are a little bit to the less common side, that can be associated with piercing headaches, like what Elaine had. But it's not the usual presentation. And maybe that, you know, was tied in a little bit to what happened in your case. But yes, headaches can definitely happen.
We're going to invite our listeners to call in. Perhaps you're at high risk for a stroke. Perhaps you have a question about prevention. Or if you're currently caretaking for a stroke victim, have questions about what to do, what to say. 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-9576. Or you can email radio@wlrn.org. Radio@wlrn.org.
It's definite the brain is such a wonderful adaptive organ. How does it able to go from where someone is almost totally incapacitated with dead brain cells and restore those functions?
So the way I explain this is imagine you have a company. You have a large company and you have lots of employees. And when you have a stroke, the company is, of course, your brain. And when you have a stroke, you lose some of those. Now, if you happen to lose personnel that are doing tasks that are not very specialized, that not require a lot of training, and you don't lose a lot of them, then some of the other ones can learn what they need to learn and then start doing the tasks so that the company functions. So that takes some time, and that's, there's lots of fatigue associated with it because your brain is working extra hard to perform tasks that it did automatically before. And that's how you recover. There's some plasticity, we call it plasticity, as you adapt. Younger people are able to do that better than older people, in part because older people also have less personnel as part of aging. However, if you were to lose some of the higher trained individuals that do very specific complex tasks, those are harder to replace.
So if you're a classical pianist, you might be a little more difficulty than just everyday living.
Not only that, but vision, for example. Vision is a very complex task that your brain does. So if you lose areas of your vision from a stroke, you don't recover it as well as you do other things. The same thing can happen with speech.
What are some things that you do that are easily recoverable?
Well,
or not as difficult to recover.
Right. Some of it can be like weakness, numbness. Those sorts of things tend to recover. Dexterity, equilibrium. But again, it depends on the location and the size of the damage.
So if there's stroke in the area of the brain that controls breathing and heart rate, you die immediately.
Yes. If that would happen, yes. And those areas are very specific. They are in the brainstem, so they're the lower part of your brain, and if they do get injured, then you're in big trouble really quick. Those don't go unnoticed, of course, and they tend to arrive to the hospital sooner than someone who just has some arm weakness. But yeah, you're absolutely right.
Elaine, where are you now in your recovery?
I'm about 99% recovered.
Wow.
I'm back riding again. And in fact, I actually wrote a book in which I killed off the doctor who misdiagnosed me.
That's one way of not dealing with anger.
Not many of us have that option.
How susceptible is Elaine, doctor, to having another stroke, having had six of them? Is she more susceptible than someone who hasn't had one?
Well, I mean, I can't comment specifically
because
I don't know all the details. But in general, if you've had one, you're a little bit increased risk to have another than someone who's never had one.
Okay.
How high or, that's difficult to say.
Elaine, I was wondering, did shame embarrassment factor into your recovery? Was that a factor for you?
What do you mean by shame or embarrassment?
Well, some people get embarrassed if they lose a function or something, or they have to work hard at getting something back.
No, I came out and I was angry. I was going to fight.
Okay.
And, I was mad at the world, and I was going to fight till I was well. And then when I was well, I was going to fight to write the book that could say what was going to happen, what had happened to me.
Doctor, do you ever see that as being a factor, though?
Attitude, for sure. Absolutely.
Somebody can give up.
Absolutely. And, depression ties along. We know that patients who have a stroke tend to have a high risk of depression. But the attitudes that you have towards the challenges that, life throws at you, how you handle that, the support that you have to go through that, it makes, a great, it impacts your recoveries significantly. There's no doubt.
Elaine, what would you say the most important lessons you got from this whole experience have been?
You cannot work through a stroke. Mm-hmm. I had thought that I could work through the headache. That's really stupid.
Okay.
The most important lesson is go to the hospital. And I do tell my friends, they go, I don't want to bother the people at the ER. And I said, you want to bother the people at the ER? Show up at 9:30 at night when there's three car accidents and you're having a real stroke. That's how you bother the people at the ER.
Chelsea in Fort Lauderdale asks if you can speak about the correlation, doctor, between symptoms of complex migraine with Aurora and stroke. And she refers to Elaine saying about her symptoms are very similar to Chelsea's that she had with migraines.
Right. So, you know, migraines with aura are a special type of migraines. They have the symptoms, which can be vision changes, similar to what Elaine has been describing. But what's different is that usually patients who have migraine headaches or migraine with aura, they've had this throughout their lives. You know, they're used to having headaches. They have a specific similar headache type pattern. Now, in your case, I don't know for sure, but this seems like this headache was out of the blue. You had not experienced this type of headaches before.
No, I did not have migraines. No.
So that is one key difference. You know, if you have a sudden onset, a new type of headache, which is severe, and then it's associated with some other loss of function, like you were having, you know, your arm or, you know, wasn't working fine. Or even if you didn't have that, if you just had a sudden onset piercing, you know, 10 out of 10 very severe headache that's unusual for you, then you should definitely go to the hospital. Totally different if you're used to having migraines, headaches, and you just have those. Now, just to round that comment up, we do know that patients people who have migraine with aura have a little higher risk of having a stroke. And we do know that's the case, and we do recommend that you take a closer look at your risk factors for stroke if you have migraine with aura, so that, you know, that risk is lower. It's not a huge risk, but we do know that they're a little bit higher risk than the average population.
Okay, Chelsea, we hope that helps. We're talking about strokes. It's an at-your-service program. We'll get to a lot of calls when we come back. Speaking with Dr. Felipe de los Rios, vascular neurology specialist, and Elaine Vietz is a South Florida stroke survivor who's written a book about her experience called Brainstorm. We'll be right back.
And 36 minutes past 1 o'clock, it is today's topical occurrence. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, also Dr. Felipe de los Rios, and of course also Elaine Vietz, who suffered a stroke how many years ago now?
10 years.
It's been 10 years.
Yeah.
It's really a remarkable recovery that she's made. Let's take some phone calls. We move along to Elizabeth in Miami. Thanks for your patience, Elizabeth.
Hi. I just wanted to share just a brief moment. My great aunt suffered a stroke on Thanksgiving last year, and we called rescue. My cousin was with her, and as was I, and we recognized immediately that she was having some vision problems and that her speech was mumbled and that she had some numbness around her mouth. And when Miami-Dade Fire Rescue arrived, they told us that they didn't think that she was having a stroke. And we persisted and said, well, you know, where do you think we should take her? And they said, well, if you think she's having a stroke, take her to Baptist. And although that was a further hospital, we took her there. They said, yes, in fact, she was having a stroke. And then she had had a history of a gastric bleed many years ago, so they didn't give her TPA. But ultimately, her gastroenterologist said she probably could have had it and would have suffered no permanent damage. So that was, to us, just a somewhat unfortunate situation all around, that fire rescue couldn't recognize the classic signs of stroke, and that this advanced information about TPA with a remote history of gastric bleed is, in fact, something she could have had.
Do you want to comment, doctor?
Yes. Well, I mean, I think this ties into the treatment of stroke specifically, and There are two interventions for stroke that we currently have at our disposal to try to prevent brain injury. So once the brain is not getting enough oxygen, enough blood flow, so that you can restore that to prevent injury. Now, this is just for the ischemic strokes, so the part where there's not enough blood going to an area of the brain. And one of them is TPA, which is the medication that you were talking about. And it's a clot buster, so it destroys clots. And it was approved in 1995. And you do have to meet certain criteria for it because the risk is bleeding. And
bleeding from other organs?
You can bleed anywhere.
Okay.
This is a medication that is infused in the vein. The main concern is bleeding in the head that happens about, you know, between 4% and 6% or so of the time.
How soon do you have to get TPA after a stroke?
So you want to make sure that you give it when there are still brain cells to save. Because once those brain cells die because they didn't get enough oxygen on time, it doesn't matter, or it actually could be harmful if you open up that artery with medications or through some other means. Because that area is already injured, irreversibly, you can't bring that area back. So we give TPA up to 4.5 hours from symptom onset. So many times we use when was the patient last seen normal. Because if you were not aware that you had the problems and then someone comes in and you don't know, you know, if the symptoms started there or they started an hour ago or 2 hours ago or so. And because there are risks with the medication. If you bleed, half of the patients who bleed actually die. So it's not something that we, you know, we take lightly. And there's a whole set of criteria as to when it's you're allowed to give it and when not. A history of bleeding in the gastrointestinal tract is one of the contraindications. You have to look at the timing and what caused it. And there's some other things, you know, I guess you have to go into the specifics of the case. So if you meet that criteria within 4.5 hours, you can get this IV medication. And then just last year, actually 2 years now, 2015, we had 5 studies that showed that there's a surgical procedure that can help as well for patients who are having a stroke. Now, it's the subset of strokes that are caused by a clot. So it's a big clot that is blocking a main artery. So the ones that go on your neck or on your head, the bigger ones. And the surgeon can go in through the artery, so it's an endovascular procedure, through the artery, they thread a line, and in the tip of that line, you can have different devices that are corkscrew, or they are like mesh, and the clot is trapped within that mesh, and then they can pull the clot out so that blood can flow.
Where do they go in?
Through the groin, usually.
How big is that clot usually?
So, you know, width-wise, it can be 3 millimeters, 2 millimeters, something like that, along those lines. Now, lengthwise, it can be quite lengthy. Depends on the type of stroke. So, you know, we've had some pretty long ones. But the fact is that the surgeon can go in and remove that clot, and also the patients who undergo this therapy, they have great outcomes, but time is important. So we only give this therapy within 6 hours from symptom onset.
We have so many calls, but I just have a question. You talk about if the brain cells have already died or
correct.
If it's a clot. How do you see exactly what's going on? You can see that brain cells have died already?
So the diagnosis is clinical. So the person evaluating you based on your symptoms and exam findings diagnoses the stroke. That's a clinical.
Right.
But then you can use a CAT scan, a head CT scan, or a brain MRI to make sure that there are no areas of irreversible brain damage or that there is no bleeding, because if there's bleeding in the head, you don't want to give these medications that will, you know, increase the bleeding.
Oh,
so
right.
So that's why we do have those tests that help us determine eligibility for these treatments.
Okay.
We'll go to Andrew in Fort Lauderdale. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, a quick question for your expert on the panel there. Is there any way to determine after the fact whether or not someone has had a stroke? Sort of like if a broken bone goes undiagnosed and heals on its own. If someone has an event like this but doesn't get treated or is misdiagnosed,
yeah, is there a footprint?
Is there a scan or, yeah, some way to X-ray and see, oh, this was broken back then, kind of thing.
Yeah, of course. So for TIAs, so the transitory ischemic attacks, no, because by definition there's no damage, so there's no footprint. But for strokes, you can see them. A brain MRI is more sensitive than a head CT scan for that. So that would be our go-to test. There are instances where even the MRI doesn't show it for some very, very small strokes. So it's not 100%. Again, the clinical part is the main thing, but the brain MRI would definitely help to show those footprints.
Okay,
I see. Oh, thank you very much.
Thank you
for
calling.
And we'll move along. Let's go to. It's been a long time. Brian in Coconut Creek. Hi there. Brian, you're up.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I had a quick question. I was recently diagnosed with obstructive sleep apnea, and I've read that strokes can be one of the outcomes of having sleep apnea over a period of time. So I had a two-part question. How exactly does sleep apnea bring about stroke? And in your practice, have you seen a lot of stroke victims who had suffered from sleep apnea?
Great. Great question. So, yes, we do know that sleep apnea is a risk factor for stroke, just like high blood pressure or diabetes is a risk factor for stroke as well. And the mechanism by which it increases the risk, I don't think we know 100% why that is. We know that patients who have sleep apnea can have changes in their blood pressure. They tend to have lower oxygen levels on their brain at night, that's one of the definitions of sleep apnea, and that changes the way the blood vessels behave inside the brain. It's usually a combination of things. Many times there's also other risk factors associated with the sleep apnea that increase the risk for stroke.
Sometimes people can have obesity,
right,
or something.
Exactly. And a stroke can cause sleep apnea too. So we know that after a stroke, patients can have sleep apnea, especially towards the short time from after they've had a stroke. So there's some studies going on and trying to see if we give sleep apnea treatment right after stroke for patients who have sleep apnea, if they do better. We don't know yet, but definitely get that condition treated and definitely check for the other risk factors as well.
Okay, Brian.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's Topical Currents. We're at your service. The latest of information about strokes with Dr. Felipe de los Rios and Elaine Vitz, who was a victim of strokes, and we'll be right back.
And we're back with today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman. We're visiting with Dr. Felipe de los Rios and also Elaine Vitz, a South Florida-based author who experienced a stroke herself and has really almost completely recovered. It's
six of them.
It's really amazing.
Yes, it is amazing. I was very lucky.
Let's see. Charles. Charles in Miami, you're up. Hi.
Yeah, hi. Good afternoon. Thanks for having me on your program, Elaine. That's great success. And, doctor, I have a question about aphasia. My wife had got that symptom moments after a bypass in her heart. And what causes that plaque or something that goes through a machine and goes into the left hemisphere? I'm not too sure about that. And does my wife have to live with that with the rest of her life? Would you know?
Yeah, so, you know, I'm very sorry to hear that happened. And aphasia is just, you know, the medical term for difficulty speaking or difficulty with language in general. There's two types. There's a type where you have a hard time expressing your thoughts. And there's also the type where you have a hard time understanding language, like if it's a foreign kind of thing. Or you can have the combination of both, which we call global aphasia. The language centers of the brain for most people are located on the left side of your brain. That's about 95%. Some people have it on the right side. But it's one of those very specialized areas that when you injure it, it's not that there's not going to be a recovery, but the recovery tends to be a little bit more slow. It depends as well as the extent of the injury, if it's a small versus a larger injury. But in general, stroke symptoms tend to improve over time as long as you keep doing rehabilitation. So I would encourage her to continue working on that rehab. And, you know, when you do procedures like bypass and those types of things, when you're messing around with fixing arteries, small pieces of cholesterol or plaque can break off and then just go downstream into the brain and cause damage, and you know that's one of the complications.
Is this like the company? Excuse me. Where I forgot his name. What is it?
Charles.
Charles. Where Charles's wife could maybe another that some other brain cells can pick up what?
Plasticity.
Yeah, the neuroplasticity. And it can be, it's difficult to predict to what extent there will be recovery and in what time period. For the most part, we see recovery happen during the first, 6 months to a year. And more recovery can happen as long as rehab and training is, continued. But to what extent, how long it will take, it's difficult to say.
Well, that's not real bad news, Charles. Yeah, a little hope there.
Sounds pretty promising.
Yeah, I appreciate the input.
Absolutely. Yeah,
it's so sad to see this. And I've been to her speech class where there's other men, attorneys and professional men out there that are acting like they're six-year-olders. It's how the brain functions. It's very sad, very sad. Anyway, thank you for your input, and you have a blessed day. Thank you, Elaine, also.
Thank you.
Thank you, Charles.
Thank you. And that's why stroke is truly such a difficult condition to have, because it happens suddenly and you were fine and then all of a sudden you're not. And that's why prevention is key. And if you do have it, then you need to be quick and then go quickly to a center through 911 EMS to a center that can help you.
And next up, we turn to Guy in Miami. Go ahead, Guy.
Yeah. Thank y'all for having the program and accepting my call. My question is, I had a stroke April the 8th of 2008, and it just something that came on me unexpectedly. I was working on a Sunday, and I kind of hit my head back. I kind of, like I pinched a nerve in my neck, and all of a sudden it's like something hit me in the head, and I fell to the ground and was blind for several minutes, and it was just really strange. So after about an hour or two, I went to the emergency room because I'd never had a headache before, and they diagnosed that I had an aneurysm rupture. Well, immediately they did some type of a surgery or something where they had put a tube in my skull or something to relieve the pressure of the blood off my brain, and they flew me to the closest hospital. Well, he done the surgery. Everything came out great. I really haven't had any kind of difficulties at all, and it's really amazing. But about 3 months after my surgery, because I had moved back to Louisiana, and this happened in South Carolina, I wasn't able to follow up with the doctor who did the surgery and stuff. But I had the bone where my temple is slid backwards, and this was about 3 months later. And when I woke up that morning and saw I had this dip in the side of my head, it kind of scared me. So I was wondering, is there anything to worry about there? I mean, it's been 7 years and ain't nothing happened, but right. I just wanted to know.
Doctor?
Yeah, well, I mean, the type of stroke that that you have, it's called subarachnoid hemorrhage. That's like the 3-5% we were talking, where blood is spilled out to the outer part of the brain because of an aneurysm rupture. And those tend to present a little bit differently. Like you said, it's a very severe sudden onset headache, a worst headache of life. And then you can have whatever symptom is associated to it that's affecting the brain. So, weakness, numbness, etc. But for the skull part, usually the neurosurgeon, you might want to speak with a neurosurgeon and make sure that that bone is where it needs to be. Again, bone offers protection from the brain from external trauma, if you hit your head or anything like that. So definitely get that checked out.
Okay, thanks for your call.
Okay, thanks for
calling.
We're very short on time. I've got two questions here from callers. Let me ask the question so we don't take up too much time. One is that somebody wants to know, Maya, the difference between an aneurysm and a stroke. And also Sarah wants to know if brain surgery can increase the risk of stroke.
So an aneurysm is an outpouching of a vessel. So the vessel normally is very smooth, and then you have an outpouching of one of the walls of the vessel. So that in itself happens in about 2% of the population. It's something that, it's not uncommon. For it to rupture, that's less common. Not all the aneurysms rupture. You don't need to have all the aneurysms repaired or fixed. But when they rupture, then there's this extra blood on the outer surface of the brain, and that is a type of stroke. It's the bleeding type of stroke. So that answers, I guess, that question. And then the other question was...
Brain surgery, can that increase the risk of stroke?
So anything where you're manipulating arteries will increase the risk of stroke per se. So it depends on the type of brain surgery that it is, but if it involves manipulating arteries, then there would be a risk.
Okay, so in hospitals. The last couple of minutes, we have to talk about this. There are three types of facilities that treat strokes. So let's go through them and tell us what certification means and how you get certified.
Right, so this is a big deal for patients and for hospitals as well. So the highest level, I'll just refer a little bit to where I practice to put it in context.
Okay.
But for example, at Baptist, we have a comprehensive stroke center, Baptist Hospital of Miami. So that hospital can offer all the stroke care-related therapies, so TPA, endovascular, management of advanced aneurysms, they can handle everything. And then we have primary stroke centers. For example, we have West Kendall and South Miami Hospital. They're primary stroke centers that are tied in within the network, and they can offer basic services, IV TPA. They cannot do endovascular, but they can definitely get started with the treatment, do the evaluations. And that's
and
a primary stroke center.
So, send them to the comprehensive?
Only the group of patients that would require the comprehensive services would be sent. Otherwise, it can be taken care of. They have neurologists, everything there. And then you have stroke-ready hospitals, which are not certified, which can provide the initial assessment. They might be able to give, you know, a TPA. There's no certification to it, but they can provide the basic services. And they are usually tied into the network in some other ways, referral, etc.
Okay, so on our website, we're going to have links to the hospitals that are the comprehensive stroke centers that are certified and to...
So there's the list is for primary and comprehensive stroke centers. But bear in mind that if you do have, you know, concern that you might be having a stroke or you have the symptoms of a stroke, you should call 911 and, you know, you should go to the closest emergency room, what EMS would recommend. They know which ones are the hospitals. You do not have to worry about carrying a list with you or anything along those lines. Right. If there's a concern, time is of the essence. Fast. Remember, face, arm, speech, time. Call 911 and they'll take you to the emergency room.
Face,
that's most appropriate.
Arm, speech, and time.
And time. That's well, right. We want to thank you both for being with us.
Indeed.
Dr. Felipe De Los Rios, leading South Florida-based vascular neurologist and researcher affiliated with the Florida International University Wertheim College of Medicine at Baptist Hospital. Thank you so much for being
Thanks,
with
Dr.
us.
Thank you for having me.
And with us also, South Florida resident Elaine Vietz, who's also an author, a stroke survivor. She's written a book about her experience, and it's called Brainstorm. And Elaine, you look great, and continued good health to you.
Well, thank you both, Bonnie and Joe.
And thanks for tuning in this hour. We hope you found the program informative. If you missed some of it or want a friend to listen, it's easy to download audio links at our website, WLRN.org. Today's program produced by Polly Landis, technical supervision from social media director Jason Zabka. Richard Ives is lead producer. And for tomorrow, we'll get the lowdown on an independent newspaper that's served the South Florida business community for 33 years. It's Miami Today, and we'll speak with the husband and wife team of editor Michael Lewis and Vice President Carmen Betancourt Lewis. Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman, thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned for Here and Now next from NPR News.